This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the past 15 years, despite global warming, air temperatures around the world have stopped going up and have leveled off. Meanwhile, carbon dioxide concentrations continue to rise. So where is all that heat going? This week, researchers reveal the answer. The heat is going deep into the Atlantic Ocean. Joining us to talk about how the oceans change as temperatures rise is Dr. Rick Spinrad. He is chief scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira. Glad to be here.
This has been sort of a puzzle, has it not?
It has been. I think it reflects the complication of the Earth system as we understand it, or as we're trying to understand it. And really, these latest results that just came out in the magazine Science yesterday reflect the benefit of having some new observations, and that is observations down to about 2 kilometers depth throughout the world's oceans. And so we didn't have the benefit of seeing what the heat structure looked like, and if you will, the oceanic heat content down to that depth. So this really is exciting new information.
How does the heat get down there? Can you give us a little detail, get into the weeds about how it descends into the ocean?
So there's a number of mechanisms, but basically the way to think of it is that the heat is transported basically like any other information or material. And in the Atlantic Ocean, for example, the general circulation is one where you get ocean waters, warm ocean waters at the surface circulating up to the northern latitudes where they tend to cool in general. They give their heat off, and then retaining some of that heat, they dive to deeper depths and recirculate then through the northern Atlantic and then the southern ocean. So this cycle of moving material and heat around is a consequence of the large global ocean circulation patterns, coupled, of course, with the atmospheric circulation. And we have to remember that part of this equation is that the salt in the ocean drives that as well. So the density of the water depends on the salinity and the temperature. So you can actually have warmer water that has a lot of salt in it that, by virtue of its density, then can sink with that heat contained within.
Mm-hmm. So the study found that the ocean circulation is actually speeding up, whereas in the past, people have been worried that the Atlantic currents, like the Gulf Stream, would slow down as a result of global warming. Why are we seeing it the opposite?
I think what we're seeing in that particular study is that there are some sets of thermostats, if you will, or control mechanisms that drive the velocity of this overturning circulation and the heat distribution throughout the ocean. And again, because we didn't have the observations as densely established for measuring temperature of the upper 2 kilometers of the ocean, we really didn't have an idea of what the general circulation looked like in 3 dimensions. So we were relying a lot on things like sea surface temperature to try to determine what's happening at depth. And as anybody who's been in a swimming pool knows, you can't judge the full heat content in the pool just by seeing what the surface temperature is. Yeah. So now that we had the new information, we got a much better idea of the general driving dynamics for that circulation throughout the full water column.
What does all this heat, this new idea of the heat circulation, what does it mean for the oceans in general then? What is the consequence of this?
Well, one of the consequences, I would say, is that we have to rethink the energy balance for the whole Earth system. And what I mean by that is we really have known for quite some time that over 90% of the heat of that system resides in the ocean, but we didn't understand the dynamic nature of it. So how does it move around? Where does it move around? When does it move around? And ultimately, how does it exchange the heat with the atmosphere and drive our weather and climate? It's a complicated system, and I think in the past, when I was a graduate student, for example, we talked about things like El Nino being a regular 7-year event. Well, we've learned a lot since then, and we know it's not a regular 7-year event. In fact, it's driven by many processes that we are just uncovering right now. And this finding with respect to the heat sink, if you will, in the deeper ocean, in the deeper Atlantic and Southern Ocean, is ultimately going to drive a better understanding and a better capability for predictability of things like the El Nino events.
I know that one research interest of yours is ocean acidification And this occurs by the oceans soaking up carbon dioxide, correct? How fast is this happening? Are the oceans acidifying at the same rate everywhere, or what's happening with it now?
Yeah, this is a really important new set of findings. 10 years ago, you and I would not even have been having this discussion. And it's really fundamental chemistry. Any high school student who's taken chemistry knows that basically when you add carbon dioxide to water, you get carbonic acid, and therefore the pH goes down. That is to say, the acidity goes up. And a few years back, a number of researchers, especially researchers at our Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Seattle, recognized that we were seeing considerable changes in the pH of the ocean water. And in fact, the ocean is, we now believe, overall 30% more acidic than it was just about 100 years ago. We are just now starting to get to the specific question that you asked, and that is, what is the distribution? What are the time scales? One of the more recent findings is that we're seeing this lowered pH water in waters that are upwelling, which means these are, if you will, older waters, waters that were exposed to the atmosphere maybe decades ago. Mm. And so this problem could be of greater magnitude than we initially perceived by looking at just the surface manifestation.
Mm-hmm. As sea levels rise as they are, what is your stance as a scientist about how we should manage the coastlines? Is there any science to suggest we can win this, or should we just abandon some of the areas? You know, people talk about the cost. When they talk about the cost of carbon in the atmosphere, they never talk about what the cost of moving people, you know, building dikes and all that figured into the equation.
Yeah, this is an important issue when you look at the what we would call community resilience in our agency at NOAA. And by that, we mean the societal, the economic, the ecological resilience. And when you've got over 5 million people and billions of dollars worth of infrastructure within just a few feet of sea level, and we are projecting sea level rise between 1 and 4 feet by the end of this century, we have to start to take into consideration the impacts. And I would argue, do the best job we can of characterizing whatever uncertainty mm-hmm. we might have in the forecast, and then accommodate that in the best recommendations we've got. We like to think at NOAA that what we are doing is providing the environmental intelligence, that is, the reliable, timely, actionable, accessible, and relevant information that the policymakers, the coastal zone planners, the state legislators can then use to make the necessary decisions.
Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you do that, providing that data, is through satellite data. And I know a few years ago we talked about potential gaps in NOAA's forecasting abilities due to the retirement of several polar orbiting satellites. Is that still a concern, should one malfunction?
The risk of a gap is real. It's one we are working on steadily. What we're trying to determine is what are the consequences of that gap in terms of any degradation of forecast capability. These, of course, are the satellites that we use for our weather forecasts, especially for the polar orbiters, those forecasts that go, say, 3 to 7 days out. And the fact of the matter is, to do this job right, you want to have a constellation of those satellites. If we have a gap in the service and mm-hmm. lose any of those, how much will that forecast degrade? Now, we're going to obviously continue to provide the forecasts and the products that we always do. And the other point is, we're researching right now a number of mechanisms that might help mitigate the problem while we try to solve the need to fill that gap. So, for example, one really interesting example is, if we do lose the capability with the polar orbiters, can we use other techniques? One fascinating technique is called radio occultation, where you basically look at how satellites are settling past the horizon in their orbit, and can you use the information on the data they are transmitting as they pass the horizon to discern something about the atmospheric content. So we're doing a lot of research to try to mitigate that gap. We're trying to do everything to make sure that we're managing the existing satellites to the fullest extent, taking best advantage of them, and we will continue to provide the products that we're that people depend on for
it us. Just seems like a simple answer is to put another satellite up there.
Well, simple in the sense of basic principles, but putting satellites up requires careful planning, timing, coordination. There are research capabilities for satellites. Recognize that what we're talking about here is maintaining a robust operational capability. Mm-hmm. And so part of this is about how well we can transition new emerging research capabilities. And you're absolutely right. There are people looking at smaller, flexible satellites that could go up. The question I have in my capacity as chief scientist and advisor to the NOAA administrator is, how can we maintain our robust observational infrastructure with research quality satellites?
Well, but shouldn't be part of that message is look at the weather changing so rapidly around the forest fires, there was a story out today about tornadoes being more lethal, the hurricanes, things like that. Is this not a no-brainer message to say, look, how can you, sort of speak, turn a blind eye to this?
It is absolutely a critical function for the American public, for industry. It is something that has got to be attended to. Recognize that NOAA provides the services that we do to every American for about 30 cents per week. And so there are many of these kinds of capabilities that we need to look at in terms of, are there additional resources that are available to satisfy these critical needs? And certainly maintaining our capability for both the short-term and mid-term forecasts, as well as the longer-term seasonal outlooks, I believe is a critical national function.
Cutting through all the Washington speak, and I say this with great, having lived in Washington and covered it for 10 years, aren't we just talking about Congress allocating money for more satellites?
Well, everybody has to do their job. And so we have to make the compelling argument. We have to demonstrate the need. We have to characterize the loss in capability. And we are working hard to do that. So we have built into our processes what I believe are the compelling arguments to satisfy this need. Mm-hmm. And yes, of course, this goes through the usual D.C. process of putting budgets together and making the compelling arguments. And I think what you'll find in our agency is that there is a uniform, strong message with respect to our capability to do this. In fact, this is part of one of our major priorities to evolve the Weather Service.
All right, Dr. Spinrad, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us, and good luck on that satellite.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ira.
Rick Spinrad, chief scientist at NOAA in Washington. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a new movie that you can see by riding only on the subway. How do you do that? It's not a projector in the subway. We'll talk about it after this break.